Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, the legislature's Republican supermajority overrides Governor Cooper's veto of their abortion bill. Tighter restrictions take effect on July 1st. Discussions in the legislature over proposed school vouchers for all become contentious. Mecklenburg County commissioners get details of the county manager's proposed budget for the next fiscal year. A major fire in the South Park area makes national news, and we may know this morning who the next CMS superintendent is. Here to discuss those stories and more is WFAE News Senior Editor Eli Portillo. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Shamaria Morrison is here. She's an education reporter at WCNC-TV. Good morning, Shamaria.
Good morning, Mike.
Hunter Sines is back with us. He's a reporter for WSOC-TV. Good morning, Hunter.
Good morning, Mike.
And Eric Spanberger, who was here mere 4 days ago, is back. He's the managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Eric, thank you for joining us again.
Hello, Mike.
So yesterday, Hunter, you were called to the scene of a major fire, an enormous fire, at what I think was going to be an apartment complex in the South Park area that resulted in fire companies from everywhere descending on that location. Exactly where did this occur?
Yeah, so this happened off of Liberty Road Drive, just on the other side of Fairview. If people know where the Ruth Chris's Steakhouse is in South Park, it's near South Park Mall, of course. There are apartment buildings that are being built that would connect to a parking deck that's already there. And so that's where just these massive flames and a huge plume of smoke could be seen for miles, starting around 9 o'clock in the morning that firefighters are responding to.
This must have been a slow news day yesterday, because it made about 3.5-4 minutes on the CBS Evening News last night. And I heard Joe Bruno's voice, which I thought was interesting because he doesn't work for Channel 3. This building was under construction, and they still have yet to determine, I believe this is accurate, a cause for the fire. Is that correct?
That's correct. There's a lot of speculation out there, especially from construction workers who were eyewitnesses there running from the flames and working on the scene. But firefighters say that this started at 9 o'clock when they got a call about a trailer fire at this construction site. We've heard a lot of different things that we just, quite frankly, aren't comfortable reporting yet, just because we don't have confirmation from firefighters on the exact cause.
I'm told that 15 workers were evacuated because this was a building under construction. And among those workers evacuated in a rather dramatic fashion was the crane operator, who found himself stranded in that crane for about almost 2 hours from the start of the fire onward. And there were concerns at the time of the crane physically melting because of the temperature of the fire.
Correct. And we heard, so 15 people were rescued by firefighters, including him. And our chopper was overhead, and you could see him trying to scramble and get out any way he could. But then the metal of the crane became far too hot. And you heard over the radio firefighters saying, if we don't keep water on that metal and keeping it cool, that thing is going to fall down, the crane. And so, long story short, they got a firefighter to go up there to him and get him the right material in order for him to climb down along with firefighters.
Wow. The problem, of course, not only was the temperature threatening to melt the metal that supported the crane, but the smoke was incredibly dense and thick and black. If you saw it on TV or in person, I don't know how you would be able to breathe in that situation.
Yeah, it was difficult. I know that some of our meteorologists were saying that with the winds at that time, I mean, people were finding debris and ashes on their driveway and in their yards 2-3 miles away. But it was definitely harder to breathe until they could get it under control. And it took several hours to do that.
Eli.
And our reporter, Steve Harrison, spoke to the uncle of that crane operator who was on the scene. And his nephew, the crane operator, had called him while he was trapped up there several times. And, you know, he just talked about how his eyes were red from the smoke and the heat and the difficulty breathing. So really dramatic. And, you know, this was an apartment building under construction. And we've seen fires like this break out in other cities where these wood-framed buildings don't have the sprinklers installed yet. And what we've heard from fire experts is that's a very vulnerable time because you basically have huge amounts of dry timber, no sprinklers installed, and no fireproofing between the levels, between the floors. So about 6 years ago, this same thing happened in Raleigh, similar blaze. And, you know, this is, as we get these wood-framed apartments built, something that, you know, if they catch fire before that fireproofing's installed, a really dangerous situation.
So 15 people were rescued. Do we know of any injuries? I know that there are several people still missing. Is that true, Hunter?
The crane operator was sent to the hospital with non-life-threatening injuries. There were two people at the scene who were evaluated and didn't want to go to the hospital, but there are two people, according to Charlotte Fire, who are still unaccounted for. I know we're going to get to it here in a minute, but we have heard from the family of one of the two people. They say, the family tells us, that the boss of their son called them to let them know that he did not make it out. Of course, I just want to clarify, Charlotte Fire has not confirmed that, but we have spoken directly with the family.
That individual is a man named DeMonte Sherrill, who is 30 years old and the father of four children, 13, 12, 10, and 5. And Channel 9 spoke with both his mother and father, Terry Campbell, and Onita Campbell.
You know, he got that job, and he was doing real good at it. So I was very, very proud of him for that.
A loving father, caring person, and he just wanted to be with his children and his family.
Of course, I guess there's still hope because it's not been confirmed, but we'll keep our fingers crossed for that family, among other things. Okay, so restrictions on abortion in North Carolina got tighter this week. The Republican supermajority in the General Assembly passed a bill banning abortions after 12 weeks at lightning speed. Governor Roy Cooper vetoed the bill, but with their supermajority, legislators overrode that veto just as fast as they passed it in the first place. There was some debate in the chamber prior to the vote with a gallery full of spectators. How would you describe the atmosphere? Shamaria.
Very, very tense. There were a lot of moments where some of the sponsors of the bill, they didn't answer questions on the bill. I'm talking about the Senate side of things. There were a lot of conversations about grandstanding. And so it was a very tense conversation. Went a little longer than I thought it would be. And that's just based on how fast the Republicans had taken this through the other two chambers prior to the veto by Governor Roy Cooper. But they did allow some speaking, not too much, but it went through nonetheless, and they were successful.
So the bill reduces the allowed time for abortions from 20 to 12 weeks, with exceptions for cases of rape, fetal abnormalities, and the life of the mother. And Republicans position this as reasonable. Democrats say it's radical. No surprise there. Each of the members of the Senate had 10 minutes to speak. A Republican, Amy Gailey from Alamance and Randolph counties, explained the GOP point of view.
We studied what has happened in other states since the Dobbs decision, and we worked hard to avoid unwanted consequences, particularly when the mother's life is in jeopardy. An ectopic pregnancy or stillborn child can still be treated with appropriate care.
But the debate quickly became heated and divisive. Again, Senator Gailey.
The number one truth about this bill is that it has exposed the Democrats for what they are, beholden to the abortion special interests they depend on to run their election machine.
Some might say that's the pot calling the kettle black, but of course Governor Cooper accused several Republican lawmakers of breaking their promises to protect women's reproductive freedom. One of those is Mecklenburg County House Member Tricia Cotham, who just weeks ago defected from the Democratic to the Republican parties. What did she say about the bill and about her decision to override the governor's veto? Eric.
Oh, I, she, I'm sorry. I anyway,
you look like you wanted to talk. So
yeah, I'm sorry. She said that this is a reasonable balance, that it represents a middle ground. She directly addressed people calling her a hypocrite because, remember, as recently as January, she was a co-sponsor on a bill that would have codified Roe v. Wade. So she says that this is right in line with her beliefs, and that the features of the bill that pertain to childcare and other ways to care for babies lines right up with the way this issue should be managed. And Mike, it will not surprise you at all, I'm sure you saw it, that she is getting absolutely hammered by her former Democratic colleagues.
Does it in fact line up with her previous statements or beliefs as we know them?
No.
Okay. Democratic Wake County Senator Gail Adcock is a family nurse practitioner. In that moment before the override took place, she made the point that so many opposed to tighter restrictions have made, that abortion is health care and decisions surrounding it should be left up to doctors and patients.
They provided evidence about the harms that will undoubtedly result if women are not allowed to make their own decisions about abortion, what is right for their unique situations, in consultation with their trusted OBGYN physician.
And Mecklenburg Democratic Senator Natasha Marcus underlined that point while also poking GOP lawmakers who she characterized as getting touchy about the backlash to the bill. The proof, she says, comes in just how quickly this bill moved through the legislature. She called it the quickest she'd ever seen and added,
I remember when I believed that the Republican Party stood for small government and personal freedom. We can debate exactly when that changed, but it's clear that if you do this to North Carolina's women and girls, if you make SB 20 the law here, you can't claim to stand on those principles anymore.
So this bill takes effect on July the 1st. What can women, families, healthcare professionals expect? Anybody. Shamari. Unmute yourself, Shamari. Shamari, you are still muted.
Well, I'll go ahead and
thank you.
Just jump in for a second. There will be, of course, the deadline for getting an abortion will move from 20 weeks to 12 weeks. There are also additional requirements around in-person visits, and how many visits and what has to be in person for people to, obtain an abortion, how many times they have to see a physician. But one thing that the GOP legislators will point to is that there's also increased funding for childcare, which you mentioned, and increased leave for families. And, you know, Mark Robinson has been trying to make that point, the lieutenant governor who is running for governor for the nomination. He's been trying to say, you know, I'm pro-life and I don't want to just talk about abortion. I want to talk about life after the baby is born. But, you know, really, I think in some ways this is the starting pistol, the real starting pistol for the 2024 race, both locally, you know, in the state legislature. And, you know, I think even nationally, I'm sure Democrats will make this a big issue and hope to make this probably one of the defining issues in North Carolina.
So physicians say the 72-hour waiting period and these extra visits to see a doctor, I think two or three times for examinations prior to getting an abortion, even at 12 weeks, is not medically necessary. So given that, is this purely political? Is it a way to discourage women from getting an abortion in the first place, particularly those who can least afford the transportation necessary to go to the doctor three or four times and the time off from work? And I have 20 seconds. Shamaria.
According to the abortion providers that I spoke to, that includes Planned Parenthood and over at Duke Health, this is exactly how you just described it, as a way to limit care for those who are looking for abortion care here, not only in North Carolina, but in the Southeast region.
There's a little more to this bill that puts additional requirements on healthcare facilities, and we'll talk about that when we come back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks and the local news roundup on listener-supported 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Eli Portillo, senior editor at WFAE News. Hunter Sines is here from WSOC-TV, Shamari Morrison from WCNC-TV, and Eric Spanberg from the Charlotte Business Journal. We were talking just before the break about the abortion override, or the legislature's override of the governor's veto of the abortion bill. That's complicated. This law imposes new requirements on facilities that perform outpatient surgical procedures. I'm assuming that means any outpatient surgical procedure facility, not just those that provide abortions. But this includes the need to have an additional, quote, ambulatory surgical center license. Shamaria, what is that? What is the justification for requiring it for already established facilities?
Now, this license is something that you'll find at a hospital or outpatient care center. These are very safe procedures that you don't have to have in the hospital setting, right? But there are still certain things that you want to have if you're doing surgical care, but it depends on the care. So currently in North Carolina, abortion clinics who do abortions at a certain point in time, if they have to be surgical, not a medical abortion, they don't need to have this ambulatory license because it is a safe practice without having some of these restrictions. So for example, like how wide do your hallways need to be, the HVAC ventilation? These are important to some surgeries, not to others. What this legislation would then do is require them to have this by October 1st of this year. And so a lot of these places are saying, well, we don't need it. And honestly, it's just something to get in the way of having us be able to operate.
And may in fact put some of these places out of business. You spoke with Dr. Jonas Schwartz about this. He's an assistant professor of obstetrics and gynecology at Duke Health. And he said this additional license is not necessary.
Across the state, clinics that provide abortion provide safe abortion in an outpatient setting, inclusive of and above 12 weeks gestation. That is not an evidence-based practice. It is not reflective of any information that we have about where abortion is safe or high quality.
So once again, what is the purpose of this?
If you ask them, it's kind of a death by a thousand cuts. Administrative things can shut places down. We've seen it happen across the state. We've seen it happen in Mississippi to their abortion clinics. So it's not always the weeks up till that can shut places down on abortion clinic access. Sometimes a lot of these places might not be able to be up to par with some of these new requirements. And Planned Parenthood has said there are some facilities here in the state who either do not have these qualifications to get this license and or will never be able to in the near future. So we may see some of them either reducing services or shutting down. We just don't know yet.
And Dr. Schwartz is not alone in that opinion. Allison Kaiser is Planned Parenthood South Atlantic Senior Director of External Affairs.
In terms of the licensure requirements, not only do we not have any facilities at this time who meet ambulatory surgical center requirements, there are some that will not be able to. At any point in the foreseeable future.
And she says this will obviously make it more difficult and more expensive for providers to continue to operate in North Carolina.
These are requirements that involve like your HVAC system, the width of the hallways in your facility. And again, this is completely medically unnecessary, particularly when you really think about the fact that 60% of abortions in North Carolina are actually medication abortions.
So the majority of Americans, the majority of North Carolinians, the majority of Republican voters are against bills like this. And during the debate prior to the veto to override the governor's, the vote to override the governor's veto, there were protesters in the gallery. How raucous did it become, Shamaria?
Towards the end of the vote, you can audibly hear it. You know, I was listening to it virtually. You can hear them. I think at one point they even had to be ushered out. But you saw lawmakers, you know, look up and approve of, you know, some of the things that they were saying. We know that there were groups there that were interest groups.
I don't know if you can answer this question, but there's a photograph that was taken of Patricia Cotham, and it's been printed several times now in the Charlotte Observer. And the caption is her mouthing the words to the people in the gallery, "I see you." What does that mean?
I don't
Anybody know?
And yeah, I wonder. I mean, I can guess, but I guess it's not my job.
Yeah, it's tough to tell exactly because there were, you know, supporters and opponents there. So, you know, it's she could have been looking at either. And from that picture, we don't have enough to say, but it has certainly spread far and wide on social media as well, with people using it in their criticisms of her.
And again, Mike, I just want to add, is there going to be a bigger story in this city, this county, perhaps this state than what she did in April, switching right. parties? And that was the vote, 72-48.
And again, I misspoke. I called her by her mother's name. Her mother is on county commission. We're referring, of course, to Tricia Cotham, who is in the State House of Representatives. Before we move on to other things that happened in the legislature this week, let's turn to CMS, where Shamaria, you're the education reporter here. They say they will have an announcement to make at noon today. They're going into emergency session this morning. That's an alarming title. Is it to put the cross the I's and dot the T's?
It is for a while. And it's just a lot of talk. It is emergency, I guess. But that's, they're going to be looking at the contract. And then eventually, once that contract is looked at, they'll announce it. They'll also then publish it. So we'll know how much money this person is making, what their name is, and a lot of other details. We're also expecting that superintendent to be available in person at 3 o'clock. And we know that up until this moment, we have had no indication on who has applied for the job. And also, who do they go through? Because they decided to make that be anonymous and a secret.
Well, one of the things that has, let's put it this way. One of the names that has leaked out and started leaking out late yesterday afternoon is the interim superintendent, Crystal Hill. And if it turns out to be her, this is the worst kept secret in the history of CMS. And there are lots of secrets at CMS over the years. If it's her, what does that say about all the money we spent on a search?
I think it says a lot, and it'll also garner a lot of questions on what happened, how it happened. And I think there are going to be a lot of people who may be upset about that. So they are going to have to very heavily defend that decision if it is in fact her. And they'll have to be prepared for what comes with that, because there are questions that need to be asked
answered. Could that explain why an interim superintendent would announce this week that through the board that they were redrawing some student district maps in South Charlotte? It seemed odd to me when I heard it that an interim superintendent would make that announcement. You would think that they would save that for the incoming super. Does that explain it then?
I don't think so. And I'll say this is why, because that boundary stuff has been in the making for a long time. Those dates have been drawn up for a very long time. And these high schools and middle schools that are relief schools are planned to open up within the next school year. So you really can't stop anything like that, even if you don't have a permanent person in the seat. So
we've been talking for a couple of weeks about the legislature's desire to expand access to opportunity scholarships to everybody who wants them. This would essentially tie the funding for education not to school districts, but to individual students. So give us a quick primer on what expansion of opportunity scholarships means.
Well, they call it backpack funding. So the premise is that for each amount of money that the state might be spending on an individual student, let's say $6,000 per student, that money gets to go to with them wherever they want to go, whether it be a private school, a charter school, or a public school. What this means, and the big changes that everyone or critics are upset about, is that the people who are eligible for these opportunity scholarships, this is to go to private schools in the area. It's expanded to anyone, no matter what your income level is. So you may have someone who has a annual income in their home of $20,000, someone who may have an annual income of $1 million. Each of them will get some money towards going to a private school who is not under the same scrutiny or has the same expectations as public schools do.
How much is some?
It's tiered. And so if you are a lower income family, you may get up to 100% of this per pupil spending. So that's $6,000 that I threw out there.
Okay, so $6,000 to spend on a private school of your choice. What does private school cost?
Not $6,000.
A lot more. So when this first came up, there were questions of the impact of this on low-income students. It sounds great on the surface, but a lot of these low-income students, even with the $6,000, will not be able to afford a private school education, which means they will have to go to the public schools, and they'll be in public schools that have been abandoned by those who can make use of these opportunity scholarships. This could have a severe impact on public education. And this week in the General Assembly, several Democratic lawmakers spoke their mind about this. One of them was Representative Julie Von Hafen from Wake County.
Republicans are pushing the most radical defunding of public education we have ever seen in this state. We have to look no further than the Senate budget just released late last night to see their priorities.
And in addition to increasing spending on opportunity scholarships, that plan includes teacher raises that GOP leaders say will average 4.5% over the coming 2 years. Democratic State Senator Rachel Hunt says that budget shows disregard for public schools and noted that the plan
proposes an additional $2.23 billion over the next 10 years to private school vouchers. A budget that proposes an average teacher raise of 3.7%. Despite inflation rising 6.5% over the biennium.
So there's a little disparity in numbers there, because I just said that the GOP leaders say that teacher pay raises will average 4.5. She just said 3.5%. But they're saying that there isn't enough money in the budget for proper teacher pay raises. Is that what she's saying?
Yeah, and it depends on who you're talking to, because remember, they haven't come until a final number between the two chambers, the House and then the Senate. And so they're just estimates. So she might be lumping them together. I'm not too sure on that. But to your point in your question, a lot of money are going to a lot of different places. But I think when it comes to those opportunity scholarships, at least at the moment, that is not directly coming out of the pot of money that goes to schools right now. But you don't know what's going to be happening in the future.
Eric?
Well, I was just going to add, when you see all these things stacking up against public education, don't forget that the state Supreme Court also reversed the earlier decision on the Leandro funding, which was a sizable amount of money. So they're getting hit from all sides.
So the big one of the people that we just played referred to this. There's a big concern over the legislature's general attitude toward public schools, and Democratic lawmakers say these plans will, quote, dismantle public education. Is that political hyperbole?
I don't think so. And I'll tell you, it's less of the whole political thing, but it's like what we're seeing. There's just so many different arguments. The people who are for these school choices are saying, you all have had forever to get it right. But despite that, a lot of these schools have been underfunded. And on the other side of things, the folks who are saying we need to put more money into public schools, they're saying that you're taking away our resources, you're putting money in other places, and we'll never get the chance to live up to what you say that you want. How can we do this if we don't have the money for it? The other side is saying, we're not going to give you the money for it because you're not doing it. So it's hard.
And here's how Senator Rachel Hunt positioned these Republican efforts.
They have shown us who they are and what they value. They are anti-public education, they are anti-teacher, and they are anti-student.
Those remarks were made at a news conference as part of a Leandro Day at the General Assembly. The Leandro decision was a decision a previous court handed down, I'm simplifying here, that said you are underfunding the schools, get on with it, and here's how much you have to pay. And now the Supreme Court has said, no, you don't. So they're still having these Leandro Day observances. But another discussion was happening inside as a part of this school voucher debate, as that was going on outside, which provoked an exchange between Iredell Republican Jeff McNeely and Wake County Democrat Abe Jones. McNeely, who is white and who favors vouchers and school choice, asked if Jones, who is black and who attended Wake County public schools, if he would have been able to attend Harvard University and Harvard Law School, which he did, if he were not an athlete or a minority.
Would you have been able to maybe achieve this if you were not an athlete or a minority or any of these things, but you were a student trapped in a school that the slowest You know, in the wild, we'll say the slowest gazelle does not survive, but yet the herd moves at that pace.
And that resulted in House Democratic Leader Robert Reeves calling for a point of order.
Okay, I'm hoping I wasn't the only one that got shocked by that comment, that the only reason you went to Harvard is because you were black and an athlete.
I did not say that. I said, did that end up being one of the reasons?
Okay, so what was the point he was trying to make there?
I'm still trying to figure it out. In all seriousness.
Stop talking.
And you even saw it in the exchange. Like, you can tell the moment that he said it, he tried to switch up like what his point was that he was trying to make. You saw the House Speaker Tim Moore also, who said he hadn't heard it at the moment. He stopped him from talking. So I think exactly in that moment, everyone knew what had been said was going to be replayed over and over and over
right.
again.
Well, so. He says, McNeely says, the point was that under the current system, the brightest child is sometimes held back. And he had begun to apologize to Representative Abe Jones before the House Speaker said, you can't talk anymore, and cut his microphone off. But then I'm told that he went to Mr. Jones later on personally and made an apology. Sometimes we misspeak, I suppose. Yesterday, another incident of gun violence, this time on a Cats bus, and this time involving not only a passenger, but a driver, Hunter.
Yeah, this happened around 11:15 outside of the Charlotte Premium Outlets down in Steel Creek, and Cats and police say that the shooting happened on a Cats bus that was on Outlets Boulevard. At that bus stop there is where it came to a rest on the curb. But a passenger and the driver got in an argument. A passenger pulled the gun out on the driver. The driver surprisingly had a gun and pulled out that gun, and they started shooting at each other. Both of them sustained gunshot wounds, were rushed to the hospital with life-threatening injuries. We don't have an update on their condition since then, but Katz has come out basically saying these operators, these bus drivers, nobody employed by them are supposed to have guns on Katz property or while doing their job. So this was a big no-no, but I think, Mike, it just potentially speaks to the problems that we've been having with our bus drivers surrounding safety.
How many passengers were on this bus?
We don't know that. I asked Katz about that, and I haven't gotten an answer back. When I was out there on the scene, I did not see another Katz bus. This could have happened before I got out there, but usually they send another Katz bus to get other passengers off.
And in 20 seconds, was this precipitated by an altercation from a passenger to the driver? Did they know each other, or was this something that had to do with something else?
I'm not sure what the argument was about, or if they knew each other personally, or if they just knew each other by riding that bus every day.
Okay. We have to take a break. We'll come back with more in just a moment. It's the Local News Roundup on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. It's the Local News Roundup. Eli Portillo is here, senior editor for WFAE News. Eric Spanberg is managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. And Hunter Sines is with us. He is a reporter for WSOC-TV. Shamari Morrison had to leave us because she is on assignment for WCNC-TV. Mecklenburg County Manager Dina DiOrio unveiled her proposed budget for the next fiscal year this week to County Commission.
Maintaining a revenue-neutral property tax rate is not possible. To achieve our many critical goals, I'm recommending a tax rate of 47.31 cents per $100 of assessed valuation. That is 1.6 cents above the revenue-neutral rate. 1 cent will fund the capital improvement plan, and 0.6 cents will fund the operating budget.
So among the items being funded with this tax increase, this proposed tax increase, are higher salaries, new facilities, and programs to help with housing and education, parks, and health care. This is just a proposal. So are commissioners likely to trim back their hopes and dreams or raise taxes? Eric.
Well, Eli looks like he wanted to jump in, but I will just say very quickly, Not clear on what the commissioners will do, but it's interesting that, so you just went through the tax increase that the county manager is proposing. Now, remember that we just had the city manager introduce his budget. It was revenue neutral. However, because of property revaluation, 90% of homeowners are going to pay higher city taxes. Now you layer this on top of it. It will be interesting to see if people start paying closer attention to local government all of a sudden.
Well, the county government now says that with this proposed budget, 91% of homeowners will experience a property tax increase. Only 55% of commercial property owners will, because the revaluations showed a great disparity in what happened at the commercial property level and the homeowner property level. What was the reaction on commission to this proposed budget in the immediate aftermath of that announcement, Eli?
Well, you know, there's been some pushback in previous meetings. You've had some county commissioners saying like, hey, Pat Kothman in particular saying, hey, you know, can we do this? Like, what does a revenue neutral budget look like? What does it look like if we don't raise taxes? But I think the bigger sentiment is kind of acceptance that there, you know, are higher revenue needs and the county needs more money. Part of that is just inflation. You know, salaries are going up and they're trying to be competitive. The city has said that they can raise salaries without raising the property tax rate, but the county, you know, says, hey, we need to pay for more. And part of it is also tied to CMS needs. You know, a very big chunk of this will go towards paying back the bonds, $2.5 billion that the county is going to let CMS ask voters for under this budget proposal. And part of it will go towards paying back bonds that the county wants to borrow for, you know, facilities like improving the jail, building new health and community resource centers in underserved parts of the county. So I think there's kind of a sense of resignation. And you've heard this from George Dunlap repeatedly, the county commission chair, where, you know, his line has kind of been, well, we have big needs in this county and, you know, we're going to need to pay for them. So I would say not necessarily enthusiasm about it, but more just kind of resigned acceptance, like, well, we need to do this. We've got expensive needs and we got to get the billions from somewhere.
Eric.
Yeah, I know we're going to talk about this more in the coming weeks and months, but it is so interesting. Two things. The first is, I guess, on the operating side, that she's recommending the full $38.9 million for CMS. We've had this conversation many times. Usually that is not the case. Usually what happens is there is, you know, a paring back of whatever CMS has asked for. And then Eli just referred to the big one, of course, $2.5 billion for schools. It was only a couple of years ago that the $1 billion bond got through. And at the time, that was the biggest in state history.
And CMS has asked for $3 billion and she's proposing $2.5 billion. It might be reduced. I suppose commission could raise it back to $3 billion, but what would that do to the schools if they didn't get their full $3 billion ask?
Well, you know, they've said that they've already trimmed down their proposal because they went back and saw, you know, it's more expensive. So they've already trimmed back their proposal, I believe, from 40 projects to 30 projects. And the 30 projects, that was supposed to be what the $3 billion would cover. So, you know, it kind of sounds like, oh, it's $2.5 billion versus $3 billion. It almost sounds like play money when you talk about it like that, but it is $500 million less than they are seeking. So they will have to cut back somewhere, either reducing the number of projects or the scope of some projects. And we won't know exactly what those trims will look like for a while because, you know, they haven't gotten to that detailed level yet.
And I should just note, we just went through, Mike, the whole state education funding, public education funding. So the pressure that's created. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, just so people know, that the new county rate is that she is proposing, Dina DiIorio, is 3.5% over the revenue neutral rate. And she says that makes the taxes on a median priced home, I'm not sure what that means, but a median priced home would see an average increase of $273 a year. That's a 17% jump. And when you add in what the city is predicting for the increase to be for a median price home, you're going to experience something between $300 and $550 more per year. So what is a median price home, Eli?
Yeah, so I've got those numbers in front of me here. And what they're talking about for the middle priced home is something about $370,000, and that's the middle one-third of houses. One interesting thing and something that's caused a lot of angst is if you look at the lower priced houses, the lowest third, their values went up the most on average. So those lower priced houses in neighborhoods, you know, that are gentrifying, changing fast, their values went up an average of 84%. So they are actually going to see bigger tax increases than the higher priced houses. The annual tax increase just from this county rate on the lowest one-third priced houses would be $312. And the tax increase on the highest one-third houses, the most expensive, that would average $289, which is a much smaller percentage of their bill. So that is something that, you know, has really caused a lot of pushback. And I was just at a housing forum yesterday with the Charlotte Journalism Collaborative. And, you know, people were saying, hey, we're going to get hit in these lower priced neighborhoods with the bigger increases than, you know, our people who have $600,000-$700,000 houses. And, you know, that on one level, it's just math. Everyone has to pay the same property tax rate in the county. You can't have different rates for different prices. But when the revaluation changes values the way we've seen, that math comes out in this distribution.
So county commissioners also on Tuesday night approved spending more than $10 million, money that the county will receive as part of a nationwide opioid settlement with pharmaceutical companies. First of all, where's the money coming from and how will they spend it?
So this is money that is part of a settlement with the distribution companies that sent the opioid pills to pharmacies, and they settled with municipalities, states, counties around the U.S. for billions and billions of dollars, basically for not monitoring what was happening with all these pills and not questioning why, you know, pharmacies were suddenly needing hundreds of thousands of these pills, or even millions in some cases. So cities, counties, states across the U.S. are figuring out what to do with their chunk of this money now. And it's analogous to the tobacco settlement. It's going to provide funding streams for the next 18 or so years. The city of Charlotte is turning over their money to the county to coordinate all the spending for health and services. And it's going to fund things like, you know, needle programs, addiction recovery, medication for people who are struggling to get off opioids. For, you know, the next almost two decades.
So they are earmarking more than $4 million on treatment and recovery, $3 million to help those with addictions find housing. Plus, there's money for naloxone, earmarking $330,000 for naloxone or Narcan, which can reverse overdoses. And Mecklenburg County's chief of staff for the Consolidated Human Services Agency says that drug can be given to every first responder in the county.
For context, that $330,000 would purchase approximately 1,000 naloxone or Narcan kits, and we'll work with various partners. We want to have a wide reach with this.
So how much of that settlement money are we anticipating receiving from this nationwide pool?
Well, on one level, it's a lot. I think it's almost $73 million, but you have to put that in the context of it being spread over almost two decades. So, you know, compared to the county's multi-billion dollar budget that we're talking about now, it's not a lot. But on the other hand, a lot of these programs, people argue, are very underfunded already. So getting $4 million more for, you know, a treatment program is a big boost. I do want to say, context-wise, if you look at the number of overdose deaths in Mecklenburg County, it is kind of staggering over the past two decades. In 2000 or 2001, I believe, 31 people died of drug overdoses in Mecklenburg County. In 2021, 237 people died. So just really a stunning increase in the last two decades. And while this funding is a good source of money to help with that, I don't think you could say that it really, you know, matches the scale of that increase in addiction and deaths that we're seeing.
So last week, we talked extensively about this proposal that came before City Council and County Commission in a joint session for a $400 million professional tennis complex to be built in West Charlotte's River District that would also include the nabbing of a major international tennis tournament. And now Mecklenburg County's Economic Development Committee wants more information before making any recommendations. Eric, what are they asking for?
I think the main thing that they want is to ensure that there is genuine year-round public access and not just to people on the west side of town. Mark Jarrell was one of the commissioners who was saying that there needs to be a concrete plan for getting people from all over the community out to that tennis center and being able to use it. And there was a lot of questioning about exactly how the county might fund this and you know, what kinds of guarantees, I guess, they could get from the developers. So those were two of the main things. The other one that came up a lot, Mike, which is interesting, is the environmental stewardship of the River District, which they have no control over. That's not their land. And they acknowledged that, but continued to lament it nonetheless.
So BMOC Capital out of Charleston is the developer. What do they want from the county and the city? How much taxpayer money do they want? What would they use it for?
So they want a third of the construction cost, which is, it's a $400 million project, so roughly $120, $130 million. I think they will take that in any division of spending from the various governments. But the way that city and county government seem to be talking about this is a third, a third, a third. We really haven't heard a lot from the state yet. There were a couple of commissioners who were saying they prefer the method that's been used a lot, where a portion of the additional property tax revenue that's created goes back to the developer on a year-by-year basis to make sure that they're doing what they guarantee. I would assume we're going to be seeing something in that vein.
So a proposed rule to limit drive-throughs in various parts of Charlotte failed to pass city council this week. This would have limited restaurant drive-throughs in places like Noda, Elizabeth, Cotswold, where a Chick-fil-A has already been slated for a drive-through only restaurant. I thought that this was part of the Unified Development Ordinances and the 2040 plan that predates that. Are they running counter to their own plan on council? And if so, Eli, why?
So this would not have banned drive-throughs anywhere. It just would have added another approval to put them in densifying places like Noda, Elizabeth, Cotswold. And the city has had this goal of making those kinds of neighborhoods more pedestrian friendly, getting away from car dependency. But this failed 8-2 at city council. Only Dimple Ejmera and Braxton Winston voted for it. And when you get down to it, people really just like drive-thrus. City council members were saying, wait, you know, if we make it hard to get drive-thrus, how are people going to get their food? I want food.
Yeah, a lot of people on council, obviously, if you go by the vote, were skeptical. Among them, city council member Ed Driggs, who says the timing just isn't right at the moment.
Until we have alternatives to cars, all we're doing is punishing people that have to drive and don't have a choice.
And prior to the vote, Councilman Braxton Winston explained that the proposed rule would not eliminate drive-thrus, as Eli just said, only add that additional step for them to be approved in certain areas.
This does not disallow people from putting drive-thrus in places. This does not disallow restaurants from existing at all.
And City Council's Tariq Bukhari summed up the divide over drive-thrus this way.
There are two sides of kind of a chasm on this council and how we view cars and car-centric stuff. Some folks believe it is needed, and that's reality. Some folks are driving towards a world where in certain parts of town they want to de-incentivize that.
I thought that was the whole discussion that surrounded the 2040 plan and the UDO, but I might have missed something. I guess we can anticipate more deviation from the plan in the future. Would that be right in a word, Eli?
Yes.
Okay. Every day, more than 100 people move to Charlotte. There are many reasons for this, but a new one might be that we have been named by U.S. News and World Report as one of the best places to live in the United States. We ranked 8th on the list. That's the good news. The bad news, or maybe it's actually the good news, is that Raleigh-Durham ranked third. They can move there. This is based on quality of life and the job market in each of the 150 cities that U.S. News & World Reports rates. And just so you know, all these newcomers looking for a new home, Green Bay, Wisconsin, ranked number one. Move there.
Paradise.
That's right. Followed by Huntsville, Alabama, Raleigh-Durham, Boulder, Colorado, Sarasota, and then Naples, Florida. Portland, Maine came in seventh, then it was us, then Colorado Springs, and Fayetteville, Arkansas, just so you know. And finally, tomorrow, Saturday, is MechDeck Day. What's that? That's the day in 1775 when the Mecklenburg County Declaration of Independence was signed a full year prior to the one you know about. I encourage you to download the podcast of Monday's show that Eric hosted that explains all of this to newcomers and more. It's pretty astounding, with John Adams accusing Thomas Jefferson of plagiarizing our declaration for his own. Okay, we're out of time. Eli Portillo from WFAE, Hunter Sines from WSOC-TV, Eric Spanberg from the Charlotte Business Journal, and previously Shamari Morrison from WCNC-TV. Thank you all for the hour.
Celebrating 25 years on the air, Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. The senior producer is Gabe Altieri. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.